So I came across today's guest on Twitter just recently, actually, and we've had a little bit of dialogue since then because I think we share same concerns, particularly about volunteer activity within the homelessness sector. Dr. Beth Watts is Senior Research Fellow at Heriot Watt University's Institute for Social Policy, Housing and Equalities Research. I think I'm right in saying you're also chair of the Housing Studies Association and even a charity trustee. Is that right, Beth?
Yeah, I'm a trustee of the Rock Trust, which is based in Edinburgh but has wider reach across Scotland and works in a number of ways with young people at risk of or experiencing homelessness. It's a great charity. You should look it up.
Certainly will do. I encourage others to do the same. So, Beth, you've shared with me some of your research papers and articles in the Guardian newspaper, for example. And in this research, you're challenging us to consider the impact and effectiveness of work with rough sleepers, perhaps in particular. Before we get on to that, can I ask you your initial reactions to the homelessness figures, the rough sleeping figures?
Yeah, I think, you know, they were another confirmation of what has been a horrendous 7 or 8 year run of increasing levels of rough sleeping in England. And, you know, we've seen those increases in a number of different measures of homelessness. So it's really incontrovertible that those rises are taking place. And a lot of analysis has been undertaken over the last few years to understand that. And I think we have a pretty good sense of what the causes are. We know that poverty is really the main underlying driver of homelessness. And we know that various policy changes, that includes welfare reform, but also cuts to local authority budgets, which reduce the resources that local councils have to respond to homelessness, have also been cut. And those things have just whittled away the safety net that's available to people. I think it's a continuation of a very depressing trend. And I really hope 2018 is the year we see it start to kick into reverse. And there are some positive developments that may help. I'm not sure the underlying causes are being addressed yet, but there are some positive moves.
The title of the Guardian newspaper article that you shared with me is Good Intentions and Old Habits Are Leading Us Astray on Homelessness. So I'm sure we're going to be looking into this in more detail in the coming conversation. But in this research, you talk very clearly about the differences between interventionalist and non-interventionalist responses to homelessness. So perhaps you could just expand on those terms for us so we understand exactly what we're talking about there.
Yeah, sure. I mean, a lot of my writing and blog posts and articles in this area were driven by a frustration with the nature of the debate, really. And there's a number of ways in which I've tried to address that along with other colleagues at iSphere. And one of them is to bring a bit of conceptual clarity, which probably sounds an academic and annoying way to start, but I do think it's helpful to just get a handle on the different kinds of responses there are to rough sleeping. And one broad distinction I think it's helpful to draw is between interventionist and non-interventionist responses. So on the one hand, non-interventionist responses don't seek to change the behaviour of those who are sleeping rough. So they are tolerant or accepting of that behaviour and don't seek to change it in any way. And I think we're talking here about traditional services like low threshold day centres, emergency accommodation, night shelters, things like that. But there is a lot of variety in that provision. So I wouldn't want to make it sound like all of those kinds of interventions work in the same way. They absolutely don't. But some of them are united by this very tolerant, open door approach that says, you know, we will give you access to food, we'll give you access to perhaps somewhere to sleep for the night. But we won't engage with you to try and, you know, encourage you, persuade you to come indoors, engage with support, that kind of thing. So on the other hand, you've got interventionist responses, which do explicitly seek to change the behaviour or change the choices, change the actions of those living on the street or rough sleeping. And they do that in a number of ways. So at the hardest end, you've got enforcement-based action. And that can look different. In England, you know, arrests are a response to rough sleeping within law in some particular circumstances and are sometimes used. You've also got things like antisocial behaviour orders, criminal behaviour orders, public space protection orders, that kind of thing, which in various different ways require people involved in street activity or sleeping rough to not be in a particular area, to not do a particular thing. It could be begging or bedding down in a particular area. But you've also got other forms of interventionism which are less about enforcement. They don't necessarily remove the choice of someone to sleep rough in the way of those hard interventions. So you've got what I call sort of technically coercive interventions. And they try and change behaviour through the threat of deprivation. So they say, if you don't do this particular thing, you won't get access to this particular thing that you want. The classic example is, of course, a benefit sanction. But there are examples in the homelessness sector. No Second Night Out, an intervention started in London and has been rolled out to other cities. Within that, they can employ, service providers can employ a single service offer. And if people don't engage with that offer of accommodation or potentially reconnection with the area they're from, they can be excluded from certain services. And then you've also got, I think, a really interesting category, which is the persuasion category, if you like. And that includes things like assertive outreach and motivational interviewing, which really try and persuade someone to behave in a different way. I just want to add to those few distinctions. There are obviously lots of other ways of cutting up the different ways to respond to rough sleeping. It's just one categorization, if you like. But I think it's a helpful one because a lot of the tone of the policy debate is about behavior change. So I think that's why it's useful to get that conceptual clarity on that. But one thing that it might be interesting for us to talk a little bit more about is whether that sort of framing as about behavior change is a helpful one anyway.
Okay, I was going to ask more sort of broadly, do you agree there are advantages and disadvantages to each approach?
Yes, I think there are. And I think that's a really good way of asking the question. I think a lot of people's intuition is that interventionist responses that seek behaviour change, and especially those at the harder end that use enforcement or coercion, are necessarily very ethically problematic. And that non-interventionist approaches that are tolerant and don't require or persuade or enforce any kind of behaviour change are ethically to be praised, and they're the way to go. They're the ethical response to homelessness. I don't think it's quite that simple. I think we have to ask a separate set of questions about each intervention before we can come to a conclusion about whether they're legitimate or not. So what is their purpose? What is their aim? And there's a lot of conversation in the print media, in social media, and in academic literature as well, about the aims being punitive, that the simple aim here is to sweep the sort of unsightly rough sleepers off the street and punish them for being poor, essentially. And I think, like, we probably all agree that is not an ethically defensible set of aims, and any policy that was explicitly aiming to do that, I think, would rightly be criticised roundly by, well, I would hope, everyone. But I think there are other aims that can underpin all of these interventions, including the interventionist ones that are using persuasion or coercion or enforcement. They can sometimes be motivated by a wish to protect the needs of a highly vulnerable group. We know that people who are sleeping rough have very complex needs, mental health problems, addiction issues that can, impair the ability of people to think about the future. And there are cases where perhaps, protecting a basic level of autonomy for those people does require a more interventionist approach. And that's really tricky territory, because I'd want to preserve people's right to choose. But I think the context of rough sleeping is a really tricky one, where I think we have to ask ourselves whose interests we're serving. So I think we have to ask what the aim of the intervention is. But I also think we have to crucially ask, what are the impacts of the intervention? And I think this is where the moral case for non-interventionist approaches weakens a little bit, because some of those approaches are simply ameliorative. They're only aiming to make the experience of rough sleeping slightly less unpleasant. And I'm not sure that's a ambitious enough aim in this area.
So. I see. Yeah. So this good intentions are not enough. You go on to say that some of these good intentions might have longer term damaging consequences for the very people that we're trying to help. Can you expand on that a little?
Yeah, sure. I think people with good intentions can have really interesting ideas in this area, but everybody should always be focused on what the actual impact of the intervention is. And I think they can cause harm in a number of ways. Some are more concerning and some are less. I mean, it might be the case that a kind of community-based attempt to give out free food, for example, might not transform the lives of the people it engages with, but it might do little harm. It might, make them slightly warmer, give them a conversation with someone. I don't think we can underestimate the importance of that, that kind of thing. But there are cases where I think they can do harm, and in a number of ways. There have been some examples of these kind of approaches absorbing a huge amount of media attention, of public attention, public endorsement, of volunteer time. If they're high profile, they can attract a lot of people wanting to help. But also in some cases of public money, of taxpayers' money. And I think, you know, there's a very interesting example from Australia of that. And I think when these kind of innovative responses that are simply ameliorating homelessness, they're not addressing the root causes, actually start to pull public money into them, I think I start to get really worried about it. There is also, I think, a legitimate question about what the longer term impacts of having a lot of open door, unconditional, low threshold services are. You know, having a big day centre that gives out free food and free showers, but isn't necessarily engaged with a bigger support agenda with the people it works with. I don't think we know what the long term impact of that, but my own view, and it's a highly contentious debate, is that we should be open minded about that. On the one hand, you have people that say, well, these sustain people in street lifestyles, they make it easier for people to stay homeless, they divert people away from engaging with support services or taking up accommodation because it makes the experience of rough sleeping sort of just that bit less unpleasant, that it's sustainable. And you've got people on the other hand who say, you know, it's absolutely ridiculous. What are we meant to do? Let people starve on the street and have nowhere to go in the day. And my own view is that I think we should be open-minded about the answer to that and try and find out. And I think the very polarized emotive debate that means that you can't really even have a conversation about it is really unhelpful. I would also argue that we should always be aiming for more than just to ameliorate the situation of people sleeping rough. So I think when members of the public want to make a difference, I would hope that these ideas are kind of accessible enough and common sense enough for people to engage with and really think, where is my money? Where is my volunteer time best devoted? Where will it make the most difference?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I've written a couple of blogs on the Hamber Help website about this over the last couple of years, but it's only very, very recently, perhaps in communicating with yourself, that I've seen this message coming from chief execs of charities, from council and government departments and the like. So is this a very recent conversation that's starting? And what is the real reason behind the conversation? Is it because public money is now in decline within the sector, so we're having to look at where best we can use any resources, whether they're public donations or whatever, where best we can use those resources?
That's interesting. I think there might be a few different things underlying it. First of all, we started talking about increased levels of homelessness and rough sleeping. And I think as you see rough sleeping becoming more visible on the street, responses to it, both policy responses, service responses, but also public compassion, they become ever more urgent. And I think we've seen sort of in lots of cities, we've seen public responses get quite a lot of high profile. And that's sort of caused some of this debate about, well, are these things helpful? Are they harmful? And I welcome that debate. So I think the increased levels of homelessness is really part of that. I think you're right to suggest that the declining level of resources is also an important context here. There are a few other things, I think. I mean, this has been a debate that's gone on for a long time, perhaps in the sector, but the increased visibility of homelessness has maybe brought it into the public domain a little bit more. You've got people writing on different sides of this debate. You know, there have been recent articles published that I've seen doing the rounds on Twitter saying, you know, we should always give to people who beg, and people saying, you know, kind of the opposite, that this is a really poor moral choice, if you like. But there are a few other things. I don't know if you're aware of the effective altruist movement. It's a set of ideas that came from a philosopher, Peter Singer, but a younger generation of activists and philosophers and young people wanting to kind of make a difference in the world have seized on his ideas and, you know, really pursued this idea that if you want to do good, you have to do good better. You have to use reason and evidence to really focus your energy where the difference can be made. And the sort of implication of that set of arguments is that not only is it not good enough to just, you know, throw a fiver in the nearest charity collection point that you see, but it's actually morally reprehensible if you can spend that money more effectively. So there are some other sort of ideas in the ether which I think might play into it.
Can you suggest some criteria, some evaluative criteria? I mean, we see a lot of groups popping up on Facebook new groups organising themselves together in order to perhaps feed the homeless on the streets once a week, that sort of thing. Can you suggest some evaluative criteria that these groups should be considering in order to judge the effectiveness, the value of their activity?
Yeah, sure. I think the first one I'd start with is what are the aims here? What's the purpose? And there are lots of different types of motivations and aims that underpin this kind of thing, from business owners not wanting rough sleepers to sort of sully the look of their business or their city centre in which they operate in, to people thinking it's their calling, it's their duty to help like this, to I think wanting to genuinely help the people involved. But I do also think we have to bear in mind that the people that give, the people that volunteer, the people that want to make a difference are also getting stuff out of that too. They're getting the kind of warm glow, that's the language Peter Singer uses, of being seen to be doing something altruistic and charitable. And I think there's a bit of a danger there if people don't reflect enough that actually becomes the driving force. I was at an event in Nottingham last week, and there were some very interesting discussions from people working in the city centres of members of the public going out and giving out, for instance, tents after a festival. Rough sleeping, and you know that getting thousands and thousands of YouTube hits, and actually the outreach workers working on the street every day seeing the negative impacts of that in terms of people kind of congregating together in the city center, vulnerable people, and you know people who aren't homeless, people who are homeless, who are very vulnerable, kind of all coming together and the negative impacts of that in a city center. So I think we need to think first about motive. What are the aims here? And is what's being prioritized the well-being of this group? And in addition to that, is it the long-term well-being of that group? Are we aiming to get them into the housing, into the kind of lives that we all choose to live, you know, rather than just fill their bellies, make them a bit warmer, give them a sleeping bag? And all those things are laudable, but I also don't think they're enough. So that's the first conversation I think it's about. It's about the aims. And I think that the second one, I'll just highlight two of the most important evaluative criteria, is about impacts. What are the long-term and short-term intended and unintended impacts of what these new approaches or old approaches, what impacts are they actually having? Are they meeting the aims that they have? Are they diverting resources away from somewhere else? Are the changes they achieve sustainable? Are the changes they achieve ambitious enough? Are they getting people into housing? Are they getting into housing and sustaining people in housing? Are they the best use of public resources relative to other things?
So do you think we're seeing a detrimental social media impact in the sector? Do you think Facebook and Twitter and other social media are partly to blame for what we're seeing? It's so much easier these days to get a group of people, to get a campaign of activists together online. 20 years ago, people would have had to have put an ad in the newspaper or talk on the radio and then rent a hall somewhere in order to meet together to discuss what they're going to be doing and perhaps to plan more effectively what they're going to be doing. So is social media, do you think that's having a detrimental impact within the sector?
I think that social media can potentially be really unhelpful here. I'm not an expert in the overall impacts of social media on this kind of thing. And I think it's conceivable that there might be positive impacts. You know, social media, and you and I both use Twitter. These things provide a platform to convey information, to engage in rational debate. There are real positives there, but definitely on the homelessness issue, you do see, bandwagons, people jumping on bandwagons where they look at something for 5 minutes, you know, for 5 seconds, 5 milliseconds even, while scrolling through it on their phone and think, oh, you know, someone's trying to do a nice thing there. That's amazing. Without any further thought or reflection or any real knowledge of what works here. And that's something I'd want to kind of emphasize. Homelessness, rough sleeping, they are a social phenomenon that we can understand. We can understand the causes and we can understand what responses work. And that's why I really emphasize that good intentions aren't enough, because good intentions are great, but they're not necessarily in line with what the evidence base says works. And actually, the evidence base might be counterintuitive or surprising, or people might not have thought these things through. So I think social media facilitates a sort of public outpouring of outrage or support for particular things. That's not necessarily correlating with what works. So I can give an example of that, if you like. I think celebrity endorsements of various kinds of interventions can be really problematic here, because they give a sort of a really strong public endorsement of what that celebrity thinks is the right or the wrong thing to do. But again, that might not be in line with expert opinion. It might not be in line with the evidence base. It might be really counterproductive. So
that's a very good point. Yes. And we're talking about evidence bases, and perhaps this is a subject for a whole different podcast episode. But what evidence base is there to suggest that, say, the large hostel system is still an effective system to deal with rough sleeping and homelessness?
Well, I think the evidence base is actually pretty clear on this. Large hostels, which congregate vulnerable individuals together in one building, in one place, and often for quite a long time, you know, the move on from large hostels is tricky in the context of a housing crisis, especially in some parts of the country. That is really not a great response to homelessness. And, you know, put yourself in that situation. I don't think that would be, you know, if I fell on hard times, where I'd want to have to stay. Yes, it provides a roof over the head, but does it provide the support needed to move out of that accommodation? And does it put you in an environment where you're most able to protect yourself, to live your life, both on the level of employment? We know that there are big work disincentive effects from being in temporary accommodation because it's very expensive. Your benefits will cover it, but if you go into work, you then become liable and it might be as much as your income. If you're in a position to be able to work, that is. But a lot of people in this situation have support needs. They have mental health problems, addiction needs, all kinds of things, and health problems. And putting them in that kind of environment where they're close by to a lot of other people with those kinds of issues, I personally think on a common sense level, sounds like an absolutely terrible idea. But we also do have quite a lot of evidence saying that it's not a great idea either. What we have evidence to say really works as an alternative to that kind of hostel provision are responses that put people who are sleeping rough straight into mainstream normal housing. So away from a concentration of people maybe with similar issues to themselves, and also wraps the support around them for their mental health problems or their addiction needs or their health needs or their social isolation to keep them in that property, to keep them, you know, able to sustain that tenancy. So yeah, I think there's a really clear evidence-based response there.
Indeed, yeah, we're seeing housing first projects, aren't we, popping up around the UK, many of them in a pilot stage at the moment. But I think that's quite exciting. I've been looking at housing first for a number of years. It's good to see that approach taking off now in the UK.
No, it's the right response for a particular group within the homeless population, and that's those with complex needs, sleeping rough or with a history of sleeping rough. And I think, yeah, I share your excitement about this development. I'm a bit sad it hasn't been quicker. I think the evidence based on this is so compelling. We don't need pilots, but it's good to see moves in that direction across the UK. Yeah.
So I wonder if you can recommend any resources, maybe online resources, for people that want to explore the whole issue of homelessness and particularly their involvement, their impact within it. You're obviously doing a lot of writing, so your articles are available. I should put links to those on the blog of the website in the show notes. But are there any other general resources that you might recommend to people, things they need to follow up and take a look at?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for sharing those links. Most of what I write now is open access, so it's not just other researchers that can access it. Members of the public can have a look too. And you know, there are some shorter and longer things that you can point people towards. There's something else that colleagues of mine recently published, funded by Crisis, a report by Sarah Johnson, Pete Mackey at Cardiff, and Jenny Wood. And it's a look at what works in response to rough sleeping. So it summarizes the evidence, not just on housing first, which people kind of having these conversations might also be aware of, but also all the other kinds of response, so assertive outreach, kind of hostel, night shelter types of provision, and yeah, other things like that. And it has a nice executive summary, and there are a few blogs you can find about that. So if you really want to have a think about what works rather than just, you know, what feels good to donate to, I think that wouldn't be a bad start. Aside from the resources, I'd really recommend that people try and be open-minded about these questions, because it's a really emotive area where we all have strong intuitions, and you know, the suffering that we see related to homelessness really kind of affects a lot of people. You know, hold off on those immediate intuitions and have a think about how the most effective responses can be supported.
That's been fascinating chatting with you, Beth. We've covered a great deal of ground there, and I'm sure there's some aspects of our conversation that I shall want to take further, perhaps explore with yourself in the future and with other guests on the podcast. So thank you very much for your time.
No problem. It was great to talk to you.
What are your thoughts? Are community groups doing enough to encourage rough sleepers to accept the professional help that's also available to them? Are you a community volunteer? What positive impacts have you witnessed as a result of the work you do? You'll find links to what Beth talked about in the podcast notes. They'll be on the blog on the website, which is www.ukhousing.news. You'll find details there of how to get in touch with us. You can even record a Vox Pop response that we may be able to use in a future podcast episode. We'd love to hear your voice. That's all for now. Do join us again. Thanks for listening.